Welcome to the Just Ingredients podcast. I'm Cara Lynn, and here we talk all things nourishing to the mind, body, and soul. This is a place where you can find just good ingredients to life. Dr. Jeff Arrington is known far and wide as an outspoken endometriosis advocate. He served as chair of the Rhetorical AAGL Endometriosis Special Interest Group and is an expert endometriosis excision surgeon and advanced minimally invasive gynecologic surgery specialist. Since the early days of his fellowship training, he has continued to challenge his knowledge and surgical skills to help patients with so-called hopeless cases of disease. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today's guest is Dr. Arrington, and I actually am really excited for the topic that he's going to talk about because, listeners, I'm going to be completely honest with you. A lot of these episodes I do, I know a lot of the information, but today is on endometriosis, and honestly, I don't know a ton about it. I know the basics, but because I haven't dealt with it or had people necessarily around me dealt with it, I just have not spent the time to research it and study it. And so I am really excited to have an expert here today to talk to us about it. So welcome to the show, Dr. Arrington.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Like I said, I know you are an expert on this, so I'm excited to pick your brain about this topic. But will you begin by just telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, so my name is Jeff Arrington. I'm actually a Utah native, born and raised in Utah. My wife and I have traveled the country, various states through training and all that. Just general medical training in Milwaukee. Did a regular OBGYN residency in Phoenix. And then I really fell in love with surgery, minimally invasive surgery. So after that, we took a year and went to Chattanooga and trained under a fellowship program there. And during that time, I got exposed to more advanced treatment, or primarily surgical treatment of endometriosis. Once I was finished, I came back to Utah and spent my first 14 years of practice in the Ogden area, just as a general OBGYN for the first maybe 12 years or so. After that, I really started pushing my practice more towards surgery. And as I did that, it became very evident very quickly that patients with endometriosis were severely underserved. And as my experience continued to grow with surgical management of endometriosis and understanding the disease, the volume and demand from patients began to increase. So I actually started merging my practice purely toward endometriosis management, advanced endometriosis surgery, and then shifting some of the other things. I've stopped delivering babies in 2017 and started moving some of the more standard gynecologic surgeries over to my partners, and solely became focused on endometriosis really since about 2017, 2018.
Wow. Okay. So you are the expert on endometriosis. All right. Let's talk about endometriosis, but will you start at the basics for everybody? Because I know all women have heard of endometriosis, but maybe they don't know exactly what that is. So what is endometriosis?
So endometriosis, number one, I mean, there are a lot of women who have heard of endometriosis, and there are a lot who have not. That's where part of the problem comes into play. It's common, once they start periods, sometimes even before they start periods, to start having typically pain issues. Sometimes gut issues are actually the first sign that they see. But endometriosis as a disease is a condition where the cells that normally line the uterus, so the ones that build up and then come out with the period, those are supposed to only be found on the very inner lining of the uterus. In patients with endometriosis, those cell types are, and those cells are found in places other than the uterus. So scattered throughout the pelvis on different ligaments, on the ovaries, on the fallopian tubes, we can see them on the bowel and the bladder, sometimes even diaphragm. You know, they've said the endometriosis cells or endometriosis tissue has been found in every organ in the body, except for potentially the spleen. Those are not common, but we need to understand that it can be found in multiple other places other than just the pelvis. And that helps give a better understanding when patients present with various symptoms. But essentially, you know, the simple explanation is they are cells that are similar but not identical to the endometrial lining of the uterus that are found in places where they're not supposed to be.
Interesting. I didn't realize endometriosis could be all over like that. And so what's causing this to go to all different organs? Why isn't it just in the pelvic area?
There's no one solid theory. I guess no one theory fits every clinical situation. The most likely, I think, in my opinion, is that these cells are deposited in the wrong place during development. While the patient is growing in their mom's belly, that those cells are deposited in places where they're not supposed to be. And then over time, they become active and start to cause the issues the closer patients get to, we call it menarche in the medical world, but the start of the period. You know, there are other theories regarding retrograde menstruation where we know based off ultrasounds and imaging that sometimes the menstrual flow will go backward, but there's a lot of flaws with that theory as well. So that one does not fit, at least my experience doesn't fit the cases that I see very well. That is probably the predominant thinking in the medical world, but that particular theory, in my opinion, is horribly, horribly flawed, and it just doesn't fit very well. There may be lymphatic spread. We have seen endometriosis implants in lymph nodes on occasion when we remove the disease. And my guess is the endometriosis itself, because we see such a broad spectrum of appearance and presentation. Endometriosis may be a collective of multiple different forms of the disease.
So endometriosis is genetic then?
Very strong genetic component. Certainly family history really increases the risk of it. We don't know exactly, you know, there's certainly genetic versus environmental components to almost everything that we see. Interestingly, there is a group out of UCLA currently that is doing some pretty neat research in sequencing of various types of endometriosis, trying to gather more information about the genetic components and genetic effect of the endometriosis.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so if it's environmental maybe and genetic, so then are there root causes of endometriosis, things contributing to it?
Not anything concrete that we know of.
Really?
I mean, way back when I was in Ogden in my first years, I participated in a study where the University of Utah was one of the sites for collection and participation, where they were looking at, with Dugway Proving Grounds here in Utah, there's a higher levels of dioxins and, you know, carcinogenic chemicals in the soil, things like that. They found a link or a higher propensity of patients with endometriosis that had higher levels of the dioxins. So, I mean, there very may well be environmental chemicals. There was a recent study out of, I believe, Japan that talked about bacterial component, just some of the toxins and things that can be expressed by bacteria that may have a link. But those studies are super, super early in their evaluations, and it's hard to really know, you know, what's going to pan out one way or the other.
Okay, that's really good to know. So does a woman, though, have any control over this at all? Like, does nutrition play a part or not necessarily?
Not that we know of. You know, from a nutrition standpoint, at least what we know now, nutrition can improve symptoms in some patients, maybe having an effect on overall body inflammation rather than directly affecting the disease itself. But as far as preventing the disease, controlling progression, there's nothing that we know of to make improvements in those sorts of things.
Okay, so I was reading the other day about inflammation, though, making like maybe the endometriosis feeling more painful or more uncomfortable, right? Things like that. So is inflammation contributing to this, or what's inflammation doing?
Yeah, inflammation is a huge part of it. And endometriosis of itself is an inflammatory disease. It causes and generates inflammation. It has local inflammation. But anytime there's something inflammatory in the body produces inflammatory markers that get into the bloodstream, cytokines and other things like that. So anywhere there's inflammation, there is going to be a whole body inflammatory effect. And so doing things to control inflammation, whether it's trying to control the inflammation of the disease itself, or decreasing gut inflammation by dietary changes, things like that. The idea is it decreases the overall body inflammatory effects, and then some patients will see an improvement in their pain symptoms. I think it's important to at least bring up the difference, though, between controlling disease and controlling symptoms, because in endometriosis, that becomes very, very important.
Okay, so then maybe we could say nutrition doesn't control the disease, but nutrition controls the symptoms.
It can, yes. In some patients, we'll get benefit from controlling inflammation.
Okay, so then that just goes back to an anti-inflammatory diet of more whole foods and fruits and veggies and less sugar, correct?
Yep, correct.
Okay, so do you think that women who are dealing with endometriosis understand the nutritional component, or that's not really discussed?
I mean, in my practice, I discuss it. You know, we talk about it, the options, but I don't think in the general view of things, it's brought up very often. Most patients who hear about nutrition and using it to control inflammation, maybe improve symptoms, probably find that out through their own research.
So then I'm wondering, are there things, though, that make the endometriosis worse or things that can make it better or not really?
It goes back to the difference between symptoms and disease. There are a number of different things that can improve symptoms. And I typically run this through in my options as we talk with patients, but dietary changes is one of them. You know, managing muscular reactions to the pain, so physical therapy, acupuncture, acupressure, all the hormones that we know of, and we hear talk about birth control pills and progesterone medicines, even some that put patients in menopause, their only proven role is to manage the symptoms and improve symptoms in some patients while they're taking them. The focus on endometriosis in the medical world, as far as, you know, medications and supplements and things like that, really focuses on symptom management and not really disease control.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't realize that. What is making endometriosis so painful for the women?
And again, that's a little bit of a loaded question, because some patients with horribly advanced endometriosis don't have any symptoms at all. Hmm. And then some patients with small amounts of disease, even a few small little spots, can have just debilitating pain. So the pain does not necessarily match the level of disease. I mean, endometriosis as an inflammatory condition, the pain symptoms typically come from the inflammatory effect. So whenever the inflammation is there, it triggers a pain response. It irritates the lining of the pelvis and the abdomen. So the peritoneal lining gets irritated, increases inflammatory markers. Bloating is a super common way that the peritoneum manifests a painful stimulus. Really, just wherever the disease is, the inflammation generates a painful stimulus that's then picked up by the nervous system and perceived as pain.
Okay, so it sounds like it would be really hard for a woman to diagnose if they have endometriosis then, because if it's not painful for some and it is for others, then you may not even know you have it, correct?
Right. And the two most common things that lead up to a diagnosis of endometriosis, by far the most common, is pain. The second is unexplained infertility. The pain one we can talk about, and we can, you know, go through the different steps and things that patients encounter. The pain by far is the most common one. But patients who have struggled with infertility and they've done all the testing, male testing is normal, other female testing is otherwise normal, but all the tests are coming up normal. One of the things that needs to be brought into the discussion is the possibility of endometriosis, because that can be a cause of unexplained infertility.
And why is it contributing to infertility?
So a couple reasons. I mean, clearly the advanced cases of endometriosis, they contribute to infertility just based on destruction of the reproductive organs. Mm. Stage 3, stage 4 disease, it can cause a lot of adhesions, things sticking together, tubes scarring down, the ovaries being covered and blocked. Endometriosis cysts within the ovary can actually decrease the function of the ovary and ovulation. But we're learning a lot more over the last, you know, decade or so, just about the inflammatory effects of endometriosis. And we know that even early stages, stage 1 and 2 disease, can have a negative effect on fertility. And the more we look into it, it looks like the inflammatory aspect of the endometriosis is actually impacting egg quality and embryo implantation. So there's been a lot of focus on the inflammatory side of endometriosis and treating the inflammatory effects of endometriosis to overcome some of the problems with infertility. It's interesting that even patients who have completely normal uterus, normal ovaries, normal tubes, if they have endometriosis in the space between kind of the cervix and the rectum or in the bowel itself, patients with endometriosis in those areas very commonly have fertility issues, even if the uterus, tubes, and ovaries are normal.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so you said treating this inflammation. So how do you treat this inflammation? Is it medicine?
The hard part is most of the medicines that are used to decrease the inflammatory effects of endometriosis and improve pain are also birth control. So they're going to prevent pregnancy. Mm. There are a lot of fertility specialists who use medicines like Lupron that put patients in temporary menopause with the idea that they're going to temporarily decrease the inflammation and then move right into IVF cycle. Talking with some of my colleagues who do fertility as well as endometriosis, they feel that there's not a whole lot of evidence to support the benefit of that, but it's a common practice. Again, the hard part, inflammation-wise, because most of the hormones used or most of the medications used for decreasing inflammation are going to prevent pregnancy, patients are really limited to probably dietary changes and other things like that to affect the overall fertility aspect. The flip side of the coin, too, is, you know, that's where potentially surgery has a role in this as well. Because if we go in and remove the endometriosis, we go in with the goal that we're removing the tissue that's causing the inflammation. And then after the patient heals, that inflammatory load would be decreased.
Okay, so I was just going to ask you about surgery. Is surgery the only way to remove endometriosis?
That currently it is. Right now, we don't have any medications or anything that magically make endometriosis disappear. It doesn't kill the cells. You know, there's not like a chemotherapy type of agent that is actually going to focus, zero in on the endometriosis cells and kill them off. Everything else short of surgery is really focused on symptom management and trying to decrease the inflammation associated with it.
Okay, so if people want to get rid of their endometriosis or decrease how much there is, surgery is the best option and only option.
Right now, that's the only option. You know, that could change as we get more information, again, from that UCLA program and as we learn more about the disease and potentially develop immunotherapies that can directly target endometriosis. But right now, none of that is available. Right now, surgery is currently the only way I know of that actually treats the disease itself.
And so tell us as a surgeon what this surgery looks like. I mean, is it invasive, not invasive? Are you scraping the endometriosis out? Tell us about it.
So typically, and I'm going to present this in my view as an endometriosis surgeon. All OBGYNs typically have some skill and training in treating endometriosis, but the way that it's treated surgically makes a huge impact on the long-term outcomes of the disease. Before I get to the way I approach it, when we look at, you know, patients often ask, you know, if I have a surgery, what are the chances that this is going to come back, or what are the chances of recurrence? The most common cause of endometriosis recurrence is endometriosis that was not treated at the time of surgery. Hmm. So it's more a persistence of disease not treated rather than true recurrence of disease. So when we get into surgical management, it becomes very important how the surgeon approaches the disease. The key components to surgery, number one, is do they know how to identify all the different appearances of endometriosis? The most common, you know, the ones that we're taught in residency are blue-black lesions, red blisters, clear blisters. There are a lot of different appearances with even, you know, if you get the camera in close enough, you can see just this little teeny, you know, 1 or 2 millimeter ulcerative lesion on the lining. You can see clear blisters. You can see white scarring. So the first key is recognizing what can or may be endometriosis. The second is knowing how to or where to look for it. So in my surgeries, I know when I'm in the abdomen, I have a very rare opportunity to gather information. We don't get to look inside the belly often. Typically, we're using ultrasounds or CT scans or MRIs. So when I have a camera inside the belly, I'm going to get as much information as I can, whether or not it's related to endometriosis. But particularly for endometriosis, I actually turn the camera, and instead of just looking up at the diaphragm, I get the camera all the way to the side of the liver, between the liver and the diaphragm, over top of the liver. I lift the liver up and look at the kidney bed in that area, because we can find endometriosis on the diaphragm, and the majority of it is actually hidden back behind where the top of the liver comes.
Oh, fascinating.
I look at the large bowel, the small bowel, the appendix. I come across the abdomen, look at the large bowel coming down the other side, all of that before I ever even get to the pelvic area. I want to evaluate all the areas that we can see endometriosis with the goal that I want to remove it wherever it is. So, you know, if it's a more advanced form of endometriosis that is causing things to stick together or adhesions to form, I take the time and get everything separated out, get everything into its normal space. And then we go area by area by area, looking for and removing anything that could be endometriosis. And I approach it the same way a dermatologist would a concerning mole. If there's an area that's involved, I want to make sure I get all the way around it and all the way under it. So we do a full excision around and under the disease with the goal that I'm removing the abnormal tissue and minimizing the chances that I'm missing any disease or leaving that behind. Now, that's different than the huge majority of OBGYNs when they go in and treat it. They'll use a technique called ablation or vaporization. They'll either use a laser or they'll use some form of cautery or heat device to burn the surface of it. But if we want to try to treat endometriosis by burning it, we have to burn it long enough and deep enough to kill all the disease. And if a patient has wide disease and they're just hitting the obvious spots, they're missing all the satellite disease that's involved. And if it carries deeper, it's almost like trying to melt an iceberg with a blow dryer. That if they just, you know, burn across the surface, you're leaving probably the most painful and symptomatic and the most difficult disease completely untreated and untouched.
Interesting. And so when you go in there and you get rid of the endometriosis, is it laser?
Most of the doctors who specialize in endometriosis, we basically focus on cutting the disease out. But there are a lot of different tools that we can use to cut it out. Some people will use a laser as a cutting tool. Some people will just use scissors as a cutting tool. There's a device that has a very rapid kind of mechanical blade that goes back and forth that can cut. I actually use scissors hooked up to energy. And as we activate that, it kind of shoots a little lightning bolt out the tip of the scissor, and it actually cuts with that electrical bolt. So a lot of different ways to do it. But the key is whatever the method they're using, they're comfortable and familiar with it, but they're also using it as a cutting tool rather than a burning or vaporizing tool.
Wow, really interesting. And so for the most part, after people have surgery, they don't have to deal with the endometriosis symptoms and issues, or... That's hard to say.
Yeah, that's what we hope for. And I don't know if there's ever been a really good, you know, we talk about recurrence and we have patients ask about recurrence. To my knowledge, I'm not aware of a study that's been done where, say, they took 100 patients and they operated on and they removed the endometriosis in this technique. And then 6 months later, 2 years later, whatever, that they took all of those patients back to the operating room, put a camera in, took a bunch of biopsies to see if there was still endometriosis there. I'm not aware of that study. Now, if we look at some of the markers that we can see related to how the patients are doing, it's not a perfect marker, but if we just look at the risk of needing a second surgery after treating endometriosis in this way, most patients, when they have surgery for endometriosis, they're told, oh, you know, you're going to need to come back every year or two. There have been a couple good studies, one recently by Dr. Roman out of Europe, that looked at patients who had an excision type of surgery and what their risk of needing another surgery was. And that risk was less than 20% over a 10-year time. And most of those patients, if they ended up going back for another surgery, it was more related to symptoms related to the uterus and performing hysterectomy than endometriosis necessarily. In my review, I haven't published it, but just my generic review of my time when I was in Ogden, we looked back over 11 years of patients to see what their risk of having another surgery was. And that was roughly 11% of patients after having an initial surgery with me. And then only 7% of those patients went on to have a hysterectomy. It's not perfectly clean data, but it gives us an idea that probably somewhere between 10 and 20% of patients will have another surgery. But that is by far better than the standard that we see with, you know, just going in and burning and routine treatment of endometriosis.
Interesting. So why don't you think more doctors do it the way that you do it if it has a better rate?
We have to be trained and learn how to do it to feel comfortable doing those types of surgeries. Now, that being said, there are a lot more doctors over the years that I'm seeing just in my colleagues locally who are moving from the burning approach to removing or excising what they can. So there are more and more doctors who are excising the stage one and stage two. But once we get up into stage threes and stage fours, those are some of the most difficult surgeries that gynecologists do. They are extremely complex when we're dealing with adhesions and trying to safely separate the bowel and trying to separate nerves and protect different organs and structures that most gynecologists come out of residency and out of training without the skill set to do that. They are extremely difficult, extremely complex surgeries. And some of them we even need to work with a multidisciplinary team where we're bringing colorectal surgeons in, sometimes urologists in, sometimes thoracic surgeons in, depending on the complexity and the things that are involved. You know, you combine that with a general OBGYN that delivers, you know, however many babies a month. They're seeing routine health patients as well as other gynecology patients. And it's hard to find the time to really do good with endometriosis when you're a jack of all trades.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so I'm actually really curious about these stages of endometriosis. We haven't touched upon this. So there's four stages, correct? 1, 2, 3,
correct.
And 4. And obviously 4 is when it's the worst and the most, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, like, if someone gets diagnosed at stage 1, is there a way to prevent it from going to 2, 3, and 4, or really it's genetics again?
It's really genetics and how it's managed. So, you know, me as a surgeon, I would much rather get a patient to surgery with stage 1 or 2 disease than stage 3 to 4. Number one, as a surgeon, it's easier to treat those ones, but also we've caught that disease early enough to where we can really prevent it from ever becoming one of those stage 3 to 4s. And I know we can say that stage 1 does not always progress through to stage 4, but we do see patients with an early diagnosis or early symptoms that it's either partially treated or they focus on just hormonal management. I call it palliation. Palliation is basically focusing on treatment of symptoms regardless of what we're using. They have early stage disease and they focus on palliation and control of symptoms, and then they get later in life to their, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and they now have advanced stage, what I call destructive type of endometriosis. If we were to get to that early, I really think that we can prevent it from ever becoming one of those advanced stage cases.
Okay, so not all stages will progress. So if you're stage 1, will you maybe stay at stage 1 for the rest of your life or not really?
You can. The stages really go off of, you know, how deep it is. Is it superficial? Is it deep? What organs are involved? Those sorts of things. Stage 1 disease typically just stays on the peritoneum, which is the lining in the pelvis, and really does not have a lot of depth and doesn't invade other organs. And I saw a patient once in her 40s that she had just stage 1 disease. It was completely covering everything in the pelvis, but it was stage 1 disease because it hadn't invaded any organs and it hadn't gone to any significant depth. It was still just on the lining. So we really don't have for those patients that do progress, we don't have a timeline on how long it takes to progress from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. There's just still a lot that we don't know. And I think that's where that research that's being done in UCLA may come in handy down the road, is that they're taking samples from all different forms of endometriosis, trying to look at the DNA sequences and things to see if we can figure out any nuance between the different forms of disease and how they behave inside the body.
Well, this is a really hard disease then. If we don't know how fast it progressed, it's hard to detect. I mean, this is sounding complicated. So tell me though, before I ask some other questions, how you know if it's stage 2 and stage 3?
So stage 1, there's a couple different classifications. The old one that we used to use was really based on fertility. So it covered not necessarily the location of disease, but the number of adhesions and what it was doing to the reproductive organs. There's a newer one out that we use now that it discusses superficial versus deep, but also the locations that it's found. So stage 1 disease is typically just on the lining of the pelvis, the peritoneal lining. There's not a lot of depth. The ovaries are normal. Tubes are normal. Stage 2, we can start to see some superficial involvement of the ovary, sometimes the back of the cervix or the appendix. And then it's essentially a scoring system, taking everything that's involved and plugging it into the scoring system that then gives you a level of what the surgery is. So the more organs or areas that are involved and the more deep disease that there is, the higher the number. And that's what puts you through the different stages of disease. Low stage 4s can have some invasive disease, say in the space between the cervix and the rectum, sometimes in the bowel. They can have an ovarian cyst that would still keep them stage 2, maybe a low stage 3. And then as we start to get more adhesions and deeper involvement in multiple organs, that's what will move a patient into a stage 3 or stage 4.
Okay, so if it's moved into multiple organs, like the liver, let's say, is it causing then other issues for that organ?
Oh, very much so. And actual liver endometriosis is not too common, but you know, any time there is an organ tissue that is being overtaken by a disease, it's going to change how that area is able to function. Most organ, other than bowel and bladder, and maybe the ureters with direct invasion, you know, bowel, we worry about bowel obstructions, full thickness bladder invasion. We, you know, there's blood in the urine, things like that, but they really, it doesn't really change how the bladder itself works. The bowel, certainly with a bowel obstruction, it can change how the bowel works. But we do see patients with deep endometriosis in the pelvis that necessarily isn't affecting the kidney directly. It's not growing in the kidney. But if that endometriosis starts to pinch the tube that takes urine from the kidney down to the bladder, the kidney will then start to back up and it'll cause damage to the kidney. And we've seen patients that have had kind of a silent kidney loss because their ureter gets pinched off. And that with the backup of the urine into the kidney, it causes kidney damage. So it can even affect organs that are connected, but a little bit remote from where the disease actually is.
Let's take a quick break to hear from our show sponsor. It is important to make sure you're getting quality ingredients that are good for your body, inside and out. Some personal lubricants contain ingredients like parabens, glycerin, or petrochemicals, which have been linked to hormone disruption. Kokanu's organic and natural lubricants are thoughtfully made with high-quality, safe ingredients such as organic coconut oil, coconut water, beeswax, and cocoa butter. They are cruelty-free, made in the USA, and their packaging is plastic-free. To Kokanu, details matter. For an exclusive discount code, head to kokanu.com. That is coconut without the T. And use code CARLIN15 for 15% off your order. My code stacks with their on-site discount, so trust me and try it today. Now back to the show. Okay, so I'm sitting here listening to this thinking, as a woman, I have no idea if I have endometriosis. Maybe I could have stage one and not even know it, right? Or even stage two and never know it. And then I'm thinking, well, do I need to go get checked for this? Because is this going to cause issues later on in life for me if it grows to stage three or four? So what are my options?
The number of patients or percentage of patients that potentially have endometriosis, the published data is basically 1 in 10 women will have endometriosis. That doesn't tell us anything regarding stage, just basically 1 in 10 are affected by the disease. So that being said, 90% are usually fine. So, you know, if you don't have any symptoms, no problems with fertility, it's really hard to make an argument that we need to chase something down that's really not affecting life. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But if, you know, if a patient has painful periods, if they have bowel pain around their period time or other times, you know, if they're having fertility concerns, those are things that at least raise some red flags to say this is something that ought to be considered and looked into. As we look back at patients' histories, one of the biggest red flags we find from younger patients is patients who miss school during middle school, high school because of period pain. They are more likely to have endometriosis than not have endometriosis.
Oh, interesting. So
that one particular piece in their history is extremely suggestive of the disease. So that, you know, as moms, as parents, you know, as people talk, you know, as kids talk, those are some of the things that really, really come up as normal. And all too often, young patients are told that, you know, period cramps are normal. It's just part of being a woman and this and that. But if they're bad enough to keep you out of school, to keep you out of activities, to really interrupt what a teenager wants to do, that's a huge red flag that endometriosis can be playing a role.
And so endometriosis could be in these 16, 17-year-olds?
Oh, yeah.
It's not something that develops later in life, like in their 20s or something?
I mean, symptoms certainly can develop later in life, but we see it all the time in patients that are younger. You know, when I get a patient in my, you know, late 20s, 30s, even 40s, where I'm seeing them for the first time, I always go back to their adolescent history and try to tease some of those things out. And it's remarkable how many of these patients did have that issue during high school, and that if it could have been picked up on earlier, could have completely changed the course of their life.
Okay, I actually want to talk about this for a second, because I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I have seen classmates of hers, friends of hers, just be in terrible pain every month. They have to miss school. And I mean, it's like either the terrible cramps or heavy bleeding or, you know, different things. But I've also seen some of those classmates like get on magnesium, omega-3s, mm-hmm. cut out sugar, and their cramps lessen yeah. tremendously. So it's not yeah. always that, oh, you have major cramps, so now you've got endometriosis. It could be a lot of other things, correct?
It could be other things, but we also need to keep in mind that it could be endometriosis. The magnesium, the omega-3s, all those sorts of things, as we talked about in the beginning, though, you know, those very much can help some of the symptoms that we see with endometriosis. I get these adolescent patients in and we talk about the different options. We talk about the dietary changes. We talk about things that they've done, things that have helped the symptoms, things that haven't helped. And some of them will choose to continue to work on those things. I feel it's important to keep in the back of their mind that there's still, you know, if the period pain is bad enough to keep them out of school, there still is a very high risk of having endometriosis. And if we focus purely on the symptom management, there still is a potential for progression of the disease. And I see patients all the time that are on either hormone palliation or, you know, they're doing dietary changes and things of that nature, chiropractic. And then we get to their late 20s and their hopes and dreams of family are pretty much taken. So focusing on symptoms is okay, but we've got to keep in the back of our minds that there could be this underlying disease that is still causing some issues going forward.
Okay. Well, I'm really curious about this because I could name 10 people right now, you yeah. know, of her friends that are dealing with this. So if I go to them and say, hey, maybe have your mom make an appointment so that you can go be checked for endometriosis, I know they're going to go to some OBGYNs and they're going to just sort of write it off like, oh, you're young. It's not an issue. Yeah. So what do we say to the OBGYN to convince them to check for this, or can they check for it?
There are some tests that are being done, particularly in the infertility, you know, the reproductive and endocrinology world. With this unexplained infertility, there's a test called Receptiva that looks at a patient's risk of having endometriosis. It doesn't definitively make the diagnosis. It's just one of those things that raises the suspicion, you know, just like knowing good history and those sorts of things. So there are tests that are being developed to try to help us understand what is your risk of having disease. It's another thing in the pile of things that help raise the suspicion of the disease. Now, most patients, when they go into a gynecologist or their pediatrician, often they're told they're too young, they can't mm-hmm. have it, which is completely false, completely false. Other times they say, you know, we don't operate on this. We just wait until you try to get pregnant, you know, and then if there's an issue, we go into surgery. But by then it can be too late. You know, they could have had 8 to 10 years of progression of the disease that could have been treated early on and never had an issue. You know, just my experience, even if we suspect that there's endometriosis in a patient that's 16, 17, 18, my experience is those patients are typically stage one, stage two. So really early stage disease that even though there may be some inflammatory effects from that, there's really not the anatomic destruction that we see in stage 3 to 4. So it can be very appropriate for those patients to choose, you know, I don't want to do a surgery right now. I'd rather focus on symptom management with the dietary changes and eating clean and low or anti-inflammatory diet type of stuff. And focusing on symptom management, whether, you know, if it's just that, sometimes they'll add hormones into it. But they do need to keep in mind that there's, even though those things are controlling the symptoms, there still is the potential of progression of disease over the years. I think one could even make an argument to say, let's focus on symptom management right now. But, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, let's consider a surgery to go in and take a look and see what's going on and see if we can get rid of the disease before it ever has a chance to become problematic.
Okay. So for these 17-year-olds that I know, it's more of being aware and then maybe in their yes. early 20s, having the surgery.
Yeah, if they want. But, you know, I bring up the symptom control with patients all the time. But that is also with the caveat that we want them to be where they want to be with symptom control. And so if we're using dietary changes, if they decide to do some simple hormone to help control, if that's not getting them where they want to be, I don't think it's fair for me as a doctor to say, you know what, you just got to suck it up and deal with it for 4 more years because we're not doing surgery till you're older. That those patients who are still significantly impacted by the pain, even though they're doing all these conservative things, there still can be a role for surgery if that's what they choose to do. And that's where kind of the informed consent aspect comes into play.
And what do you mean by informed consent?
It's a discussion between a provider and a patient. First, we gather all the information we can. We go over the history. We take the pertinent things in the history to determine what is your risk of having a disease. And then if needed, you know, we use tests, whether it's blood tests, whether it's laboratory tests, whether it's imaging or ultrasound, to try to get more information about what might be going on. So from an endometriosis standpoint, you know, a lot of my teenage patients are not going to tolerate an ultrasound that we need to do or that I like to do for endometriosis. But for older patients, we can use ultrasound, what I call a dynamic ultrasound and a scoring system, to really, you know, based on your history, I think you have endometriosis. But based when we use the ultrasound, I can come pretty close to staging my patients based on my ultrasound. Depending on how the ovaries look, are there cysts? How does the uterus look? Does it look like there's invasion into the bowel? Are there signs that organs are sticking together? We can detect all that a lot of times on ultrasound to give that patient information. Say, you know, and if everything looks clean on the ultrasound, or if they're 17 and we just say, look, you're 17, that you probably have endo, but it's probably an earlier stage. You know, you may decide to just manage symptoms, but they need to be aware if they choose to manage symptoms that the disease can progress. That's part of the discussion that I think I would venture to say 95% of gynecologists leave out of the discussion. Is that clearly we know there are risks to treatment. There are risks to certain hormones. There are risks to surgeries. But in the endometriosis patient, there are also risks to not doing anything or to focusing on pain management. We can use different things to help control symptoms and help patients be functional, but they have to be aware that over years, there is a chance that this disease can progress and become more invasive. It can, you know, potentially cause bowel obstructions. They could get to their mid to late 20s and realize that they can't have kids naturally. And that is a huge thing. That is a huge thing for patients, that they get to that point and they feel completely let down by all the years of care they've received because they were never told that that was a risk.
Yeah. Okay. So I have another question about these teens, because I do know some of these teens have been put on birth control for endometriosis. And so I know you touched upon this earlier, but is the birth control actually helping the endometriosis or just helping manage the symptoms?
The only thing that they've been proven to do in studies is help manage symptoms. One of our governing bodies, ACOG, they put out a bulletin regarding endometriosis management. And my opinion, there's a lot of flaws in that bulletin. But, you know, doctors are taught all the time in residency, and we tell patients all the time that we're going to use the hormones or use the birth control to suppress the disease or prevent progression of the disease. Number one, nobody ever defines what they mean by suppression. Nobody ever defines what they mean by suppression. In my view, it probably suppresses the inflammatory effect of it, but we don't know what it does to the cellular effect of it. Does it change it from a predominantly, you know, glandular disease to a predominantly scarring and stromal and fibrotic form of disease? We don't know the answer to that. In that particular bulletin, there's a little sentence in there that says there are no data to support the use of hormones to prevent progression of endometriosis. So doctors tell all their patients all the time, we're going to put you on this to prevent progression of the disease, without a single study to back that up.
Wow. I think a lot of people are going to be shocked by what you just said, because I have heard so many people say, yeah, I'm on birth control to slow down my endometriosis or to help get rid of it.
There is no medicine that gets rid of it. There's nothing that kills off the cells. There's nothing that makes it go away. You know, I talk to patients all the time that have had kind of a partial surgery, and their surgery tells, you know, we'll put you on this medicine or put you on Lupron or put you into menopause to kill off the rest. There's nothing that kills off the rest.
I feel like this is a really disservice to women, because in fact, I had a lady the other day that told me, oh, I'm on birth control. I hate it. I feel so moody on it, but my doctor told me I have to be on it for my endometriosis. That's not true then. She could maybe manage those symptoms a different way.
Yeah. And again, the hormones are basically just another tool in that in that bag of symptom management. You know, we've mentioned the dietary changes, the physical therapy, acupuncture, acupressure, cognitive therapies on how to manage pain and get through painful episodes. Hormones fall in that same category, according to all the studies that we have.
So it's a toolbox of different tools that can help you with the pain and managing symptoms, but it is just one of the tools, and it's not a tool you have to use if you don't want to.
Right. And it's interesting, you know, there's a lot of patients go through what we call hormone shopping, where they, you know, they start on a birth control pill and that maybe works for a bit or doesn't work. And so they'll switch them to a different one or switch them to a different one or switch them to an IUD or give them a shot that puts them into menopause or a pill that puts them into menopause. You know, some patients will respond to different hormones a different way, but when we compare those hormones head to head, they all work about the same. There isn't one that does a better job than the other ones when we test them head to head. So the idea that we hormone shop, just, you know, going through this one's not working, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this, again, may not be supported by data either.
Maybe is it that one certain type gives better side effects than the other for that individual person?
Certainly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and management or tolerance of side effects is a huge part. You know, some patients on a regular birth control pill, the nausea or other emotional effects are just too great. And they may do better on a progesterone only or on an IUD that has lower blood levels of hormone. Certainly some of the bigger ones that put patients into menopause, I mean, that's a whole different level of potential side effect issues, especially, you know, patients in their teens and early 20s, when they're trying to put on bone that has to last them for the rest of their life, to put them on medications that block that bone deposition and put them risk at osteoporosis. To me, in my opinion, that's horrible management. I mean, not only from an endometriosis standpoint, but you're blocking bone development in patients at the most critical time of their life that could develop into other issues as they get older.
Wow. I actually am sitting here feeling really sad for the 16, 17, 18 year olds who are told your only option is birth control to lessen this. Yeah. And so why aren't doctors talking about the chiropractic, the nutrition, the acupuncture, just because that's woo-woo to them?
Just because we're told that, you know, the first line is birth control. You know, but I mean, certainly there are a number of other things that could be used to help manage symptoms. Dr. Iris Orbuch has published a book, Ways to Deal with Endometriosis-Related Symptoms. Not to throw a plug out, but it's a spectacular resource. But, you know, doctors coming in and saying your only option is birth control is a very paternalistic approach to treating a patient. Completely takes away all patient autonomy. The doctor is making the decision for the patient. And that usually follows an extreme lack of informed consent for that patient to make her own decision.
Okay. As we wrap up, I do have a couple last questions. Have you found that one of those tools in the toolbox works the best to help people with their symptoms, or really it's an individual thing?
It's really just an individual thing, you know, and there clearly from a dietary standpoint, I am the first to admit that, you know, general medicine, Western medicine, we don't understand even come close to understanding what dietary changes and modifications and supplements and things like that can do for a disease. But some patients do really, really well with dietary modifications. And for some patients, that's all they're looking for. You know, they're not really concerned maybe about fertility down the road. They're not having any major issues with organ systems. And so focusing on symptom management is all they're looking for. And I don't, you know, it's one of those things where dietary changes, there's really not a lot of risk to having them try that. If it works, great. If it doesn't, you know, we've tried it and there's some other changes that can be made. Same thing with acupuncture, acupressure, dry needling, those sorts of things. There's very, you know, a lot of these things, there's very low risk for patients to try. And if it works, great, we'll take anything we can get.
Okay. So one other question as we wrap up, are there any other misconceptions out there or myths out there that are common that you wish everybody knew? Or did we touch upon them?
I think most of them we touched upon. Again, the myth that young patients can't have endometriosis. It's interesting that often one of the first symptoms that young patients have are actually bowel issues. And so they end up in the GI clinics. diagnosed with IBS. And if we just listen to their period history, we find out that it's probably caused by endo. So understanding that young patients can have endometriosis, young patients can be significantly impacted by endometriosis, both from a physical standpoint, a social standpoint, an emotional standpoint. You know, patients are told all the time that it's all in their head, that it can't be endo. I mean, imagine the effects of that on a patient. To be told year for years and years and years that it's all in your head. I had a patient recently that she was admitted and agreed to be admitted to an inpatient psych ward for 4 days because she was convinced that it was all in her head. And she ended up having an emergency bowel resection because her endometriosis had closed off her bowel.
Wow.
Doctors listening to patients, by listening, they can really get a good idea on whether or not it's there. There's a lot of discussion regarding, you know, how endometriosis gets where it does. Again, the retrograde menstruation is a very common one. But again, my opinion is that etiology is pretty flawed when it comes to causes. Number two, or one of the ones we haven't hit on, is that hysterectomy cures endometriosis, or hysterectomy is the definitive diagnosis of endometriosis. Hysterectomy does nothing for endometriosis. I mean, if you think about the definition of endometriosis, it's a disease that grows outside the uterus. So removing a uterus to treat a disease that grows outside the uterus, thinking it's magically going to make it go away, again, not a single study to support that.
Wow.
Hysterectomy can improve pain in some patients, but removing the uterus and removing the ovaries is not magically going to make bowel endometriosis disappear or diaphragm endometriosis disappear. We see that all the time.
I was going to say, I know someone who had a hysterectomy because of her endometriosis. Yeah. So,
yeah, a lot of times patients go in and they remove a completely normal organ. If they look at the pathology, the uterus is completely normal to treat a disease that by definition grows outside the uterus. That is extremely damaging myth.
Yeah, that's a bad one. Well, I'm glad I asked you that question, and I'm so glad I had you on the show because I've learned a lot, and I know a lot of moms, a lot of women have learned a lot. This is great information for people to have. Where could my listeners learn more from you or get in contact with you?
So our clinic website is endowest.net, N-E-T. I do have Facebook and Instagram. Facebook, if I remember right, it's Jeff Arrington Endosurgeon, I think hyphen endosurgeon. Instagram is Dr. Jeff Endosurgeon. My practice also has Endo West handles on both of those social media platforms. You know, I interact with patients all the time. I like to post interesting things. I probably tend to call out my colleagues more than maybe I ought to, but, you know, just pointing out some of the things that we've talked about today, you know, things that don't really come from a point of animus, but a point of frustration with my profession. As I listen to these patients share their experiences with me, at times it just becomes overwhelming and frustrating. And just, I mean, it requires a voice to really try to drive change. The patient population and patient advocates over the last, you know, decade plus have really risen the level of their voices to the point where hopefully at some point they'll be heard.
Well, thank you for your voice of change, because change honestly doesn't happen without those educating. And so you're educating more as to what's out there and what's available. I talk about this all the time, and I tell my listeners, my followers, if you don't have a doctor that's not listening to you and having a full conversation about all the different options and things that are out there, it's okay to say to them, thank you so much for your time, and move on and find one that will listen to you.
Hopefully we'll get to the point where we have more doctors that will listen, but also more doctors that know their limitations, more doctors that are comfortable listening to their patients and referring when needed. There's a lot of growth and progress that we still need to make.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you again so much for being on this show. I really appreciate it. I always end my episodes by asking my guests what they have found to be the best ingredient in life. What would you say it is?
So as I've thought about this, I've really come down to the best ingredient in life for me is really just understanding and being grateful for the constant opportunities that we have to do better. Mm. That just because I mess up, or just because something doesn't go the way I want it to, or because, you know, I make a choice that I may not agree with, that I have opportunities to do better. to learn from it and do better.
I love that. You know, I've done about 150 episodes and I don't think anybody has ever chosen that as the best ingredient. And I actually really like that because none of us are perfect. We're always going to have that opportunity to do better, but to be grateful for it and take advantage of that and do better the next time. Yep. So thank you so much. I love that. I'm actually going to ponder on that today because that's a really good Sounds thought. Good. So thank you again for being here and for all that you're doing out there, trying to educate others and educate other doctors. I really appreciate it. And again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. And again, your platform is huge. And I've heard from people, you know, patients and colleagues all over the country when we announced that we were going to do this, that are just thrilled. This is going to reach an audience and gives a platform for endometriosis that will just increase the awareness significantly. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Remember to subscribe to the Just Ingredients podcast to learn more about your health and good ingredients to life. Plus, get daily tips at just.ingredients on Instagram.